Welcome to this incredibly special Blind Veterans Remembrance podcast. My name is Tim Eckersley and I'm the Military and Engagement Lead for Blind Veterans UK. I'm a Royal Navy veteran having served 22 years and reached the rank of Chief Petty Officer as a physical trainer. Today we have the absolute privilege to hear from one of our last surviving World War II veterans involved in the Arctic convoys and D-Day. He is a man that at 98 years of age has achieved more than some of us could do in two lifetimes. He's met our late Queen, our new King, a US president and two prime ministers, telling one of them off actually. He's here today to talk to us about his life and career in the Royal Navy throughout the Second World War. It gives me great pleasure to introduce World War II veteran Alec Penstone and joining us as well to support Alec's his friends, James, Tanya and George. Welcome to you all and thank you Alec for speaking to Blind Veterans UK on this very special podcast.
Hello. Thank you very much indeed, Tim, for the opportunity of not only speaking to you, but of saying a grateful thanks for all you're doing for us blind veterans. My name is Alec William George Penstone. I was born on the 25th of April, 1925, and because you're always named firstborn son after the father, so my name was Alec. And of course, William came in because William Shakespeare was born on the same day and also died 58 years later on the same. George, because of the St. George and the Dragon. And just in case you're wondering, no, I did not marry the dragon. A beautiful lady that I met soon after I joined the Royal Navy.
Right. Alec, so the war broke out on September 1939, and at that time you were 14, weren't you, living in Topman in North London. So what was that? What was it like at 14 years old when the war broke out?
My father had died just a week after my 14th birthday, which was in April 1939, after Dunkirk. When we stood alone, waiting for Germany to invade us, which we fully expected to do, I decided, as well as working in the munition factory, I would join the ARP as a part-time messenger, which was because at that time they were bombing all the airfields in and around London to try and destroy the RAF. So anyway, I decided I would try and do a bit more. And one particular time, I've just come off a night duty, and the air raid siren went off. A bus or a lorry had knocked down a wall, a sandbag wall, from an air raid shelter. It was built half on the pavement and half in the road. And I had to make sure that they reinstated on there. So I got up as far as the shelter of the yard, council yard, saw the men in there, and they agreed that they would come down, renew all the sandbag blast wall in front. And at that precise moment, there was a battle going on above with hurricanes and Spitfires. Suddenly, a German plane swooped down and machine gunned a train standing at Finsbury Park Station in North London, set it alight, and then just for the sheer hell of it, decided to go carry along the railway lines to the next railway bridge, in which I was sheltering underneath. But in the meantime, he was machine gunning all the people out shopping on the Saturday afternoon. There was glass and bullets and everything else flying all over the place. And as luck would have it, the only gun that was defending the bridge was a Beaufort's low angle anti-aircraft gun. And as he swooped down, it hit him fair and square. And it zoomed up in the air. And I looked out from underneath the bridge and saw he was on smoke on there. And I knew the only open space he could see was a big recreation ground called Markfield Recreation Ground, which is about a mile and a half away. And I decided that that's where he was going to try and make his landing there, because he didn't want to land on the rooftops of the town. So luckily, I was on one of the old bikes, grocery bikes, with the metal front on it where you put the basket. But it was fixed wheel, but it was downhill. So I was pedaling away like mad. And I'm a policeman also on a bike. And I called him Markfield Rec, and he gave me the thumbs up. And together we went to the back entrance of Markfield Rec. When we got there, the pilot already landed, and he was standing there looking in utter amazement at a group of about 40 men and women fighting each other for his parachute, which had drifted off down the field. And he was absolutely standing there waiting for it. And my policeman went up to him, took the pilot's revolver out from his holster, emptied out and put one of the shells back up the spout, waved it in his face and said, put your hands behind your back. And in perfect Oxford BBC accent, came the words, I'm a prisoner of war and I demand respect. We both looked at each other. Where did that voice come from? It's a German pilot dressed in all his uniform and he's speaking perfect English. Because it turned out he was educated at Oxford before the war. Anyway, the policeman said, you'll get more than respect if I called those women over and tell them that 20 minutes ago you were machine gunning their families while out shopping. I won't be able to guarantee your safety. Now, do as you're told. And we took him up to a factory at the top. And they called up for transport because, you know, we didn't have mobile phones or anything like that. And a motorcycle combination came through the gates, driven by a policeman. We put the pilot in the sidecar. My policeman got on his back, left me with two bikes. So off they went. I said, what about your bike? He always said, take it to the warden's post. I'll pick it up later. Mile and a half walk with two bikes pushing uphill. It just ain't no justice. That was my first one on there.
Did you keep it?
Did you keep
the bike? I had it for 3 weeks until the wall fell on it.
The other story from that time, Alec, which is very striking, is when there was a bombing raid and you had to help out with an air raid shelter.
Oh, that was September the 15th, which is now Battle of Britain Day. That's when Hitler tried to burn London.
Okay,
wow. He dropped hundreds of incendiary bombs, first of all, followed by high explosives on the drifter. And the air raid warden's post was built in the yard of an old piano factory in Tottenham, and concrete and bricks and that sort of thing, and the end of a row of houses. And we were in there, we just turned up, and all of a sudden we heard a stick of bombs coming down. We always counted them, about five or six in a stick. Each one got nearer and nearer until there was a massive great explosion and all their lights went out. And we rushed outside because the post warden also lived in the same road where he was worried about his family. And we found that a bomb had dropped between the air raid shelter, which was the old Anderson shelter in the back garden of the first house, and the house, and brought the whole of the side of the house down on top of the air raid shelter, on top of the entrance. The gas main promptly caught fire and sent the flames circling up in the air of gas, coal gas as it was in those days, and they're burning brightly. And of course, once they saw the flames there, they were trying to spread it, dropping more bombs on it. And we knew there was four people in the air raid shelter, in the Anderson shelter, because we'd helped them build the bunks on there. And because you couldn't get in the front, I was given a torch and a spanner to go around to the back. I was 15 years of age then, and undo the escape hatch at the back, which is about 2 foot square of corrugated iron from the outside, which I did. I heard the screaming coming from inside there, and I knew people were still alive in there. And when I finally got the back off and climbed through, I couldn't see anything for thick smoke inside. The screaming was still going on. And I found that the whole floor of the air raid shelter had been lifted upwards, and the two men in the top bunk were pressed hard against the top of the air raid shelter, and the two women that were on bunks underneath, I managed to get them out, but they were like bags of jelly. They had no bones. I had to pull them out. It was just like a terrible feeling. And I passed them out, my friends outside, who pulled them out into the road. They were both dead. And then I got one of the men down from the top. He was dead. And then suddenly the man stopped screaming up there, and I knew he'd gone as well. So I managed to get all four of them out. I mean, I was only a little titch myself, but somehow I managed to get, and they managed to pull him out onto the road. And when the taxi came along as an ambulance with the body bags in it, we couldn't take away the fourth body until we found the man's left foot, which had been cut off during the explosion. And they wouldn't take the body away until we found his foot amongst the rubble. All this time, the flames were shooting outside and Jerry was doing his bombing raid. And as pure luck, a whistle of bombs came down and it actually hit the road and hit the gas main further up the road, which turned our gas off. It just died down suddenly. The flames were still going high because all the wood in the house was burning, all the furniture, the beds and everything else. Like, you know. But yeah, we got away with that one.
What a fantastic story of courage that is, you know, doing that at 15 years of age.
And because my mother was a newly war widow, because my father had been in Queen Mary's Hospital, Roehampton, for a number of years, completely paralysed from his wounds from the First World War. And I promised him that I would not join the army. So I made it my business to make sure that I joined the Royal Navy, or the Merchant Navy at the time. And as soon as I was 17, although I was doing a 12-hour shift in the factory, 12-hour nights, 1 week, 12-hour days, the next week, every time I was off on my days, I would go down to Dock Street in London to sign on for the Merchant Navy. But all they kept offering me was deckhand. It was engine room, and I wanted deckhand. So in the end, they said to me, go down to Edgware and join the Royal Navy. Three coughs later, I was signed up.
So
June the 16th.
Right. And Alec, you joined as an anti-submarine detection investigating committee?
I joined as an ordinary mating, first of all. But after 2 weeks square bashing down on Devonport, I was asked if I wanted either radar or ASDICs. When I asked which paid the best, because my mother was a war widow, every penny helped, they said ASDICs does. So I put my name down for ASDICs. Next thing I know, I'm sent off to Campbelltown in Scotland to be trained as a submarine detector.
So I understand that your first raft was actually on a World War One submarine. Was that?
That was
part of your first Arctic convoy, wasn't it?
Yes. What happened was I was told to go to Scapa, pick up a boat at Scapa. Well, a boat to me was like a drifter. And when I got there, I was told to go down to the third boat alongside after I'd been given something to eat. And I found she was a submarine. And when I met the officer on the watch there, he must have been about 8 weeks older than me. He was Wavy Navy, and he must have bought him a commission in the reserves. And he said to me, like, you know, I said, well, excuse me, sir, but I didn't volunteer for submarines. He said, hard luck, take it up with your drafting office if we get back. I said, where are we going, sir? He said, Murmansk. Well, having heard the old salts talking about the Russian run, I thought my naval career is going to finish before I've even started. He said, go down below and they will show you your bunk. When I got down there, the leading seaman said, there's your bunk. I said, well, there's somebody asleep in it. He said, yeah, he's your oppo. When he gets out, you get in. He said, don't worry about it. He said, you get $10 a day extra for that, which I thought was pretty good going. So anyway, we set sail just after midnight on that day. And once off the Icelandic coast, the captain decided he was going to try and do a dive. So when we got down 30 foot, there's more water coming in through broken seals and loose rivets than what there was outside. So we had to blow the tanks rather quickly and return to the surface. And I remember the skipper sending a message to the leader of the escorts. In the event of an air attack, I intend to remain on the surface. Back come the answer, so do we all. Congratulations, see you in Mansk. And that was it. We were not fit for purpose. I was turned round, just a bare island, to go back with the convoy returning back to England. And while I was back in the UK, I arrived back in the early hours of Christmas Eve. I was given 7 days leave to do with me. And back in London to find that my mother and brother had been evacuated because of the bombing. And I had nowhere to go for Christmas dinner. But I had a ration card, but all the shops were shut. So I thought, well, I've got to find somewhere to have some Christmas dinner. So I decided that I would go to see my aunt, my mother's sister. My two cousins were on the Navy as well, aren't there? And when I went to them, there was a young lady there who introduced herself as my cousin's fiancée, and they were going to get married on his next long leave. He was out on the sweepers out of Harwich. And I have to walk her home, and pitch dark by that time, got to her house, and so coming to meet the family, and there was this gorgeous 17-year-old young lady, an acrobatic dancer, been given a month's leave from a factory where she made aircraft seats to do entertainment. And the rest is history. I fell in love with her, and we married 2 years later.
Wow. And all that, what a chance encounter, all based on the fact that you were going to spend Christmas alone.